Blog Talk Radio.
But the point is that I know how to handle these crises.
We are and always will be the United States of America.
Excuse me, Fox News.
A series of tubes.
I think we look pretty good.
I'll get Osama bin Laden, my friends. I'll get him. I know how to get him.
E pluribus unum. Out of many...
If some of those jobs are lost in this, so be it.
Thank you, Wisconsin!
Liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, moderates of all opinions, welcome to Civil Discourse. My name is Eric Brandt, and with me, as always, is former State Senator Peter Baer. How's it going, Peter?
Going great, Eric. How are you doing?
I am doing great. You are listening to Civil Discourse on Janesville Community Radio. We are live every Saturday at 11 a.m. Central Standard Time. Just go to blogtalkradio.com, do a search for Janesville Community Radio, click on their link, and then the link for Civil Discourse. You can also hear us archived at the same link anytime, and you can also hear kind of a best of Civil Discourse at civildiscourse.podomatic.com. We're going to be joined by Mike McCabe in the second half of the show. Mike has a new book coming out, and he's got some very insightful thoughts for everybody. So I really encourage all of you to stick around, because Mike is going to do an amazing job. It's a recorded interview. Mike is busy today, actually. So if you would like to call in with any of your thoughts, we would ask that you do it in the first half of the show, 323-580-5769. And we're going to kind of jump into this because we've got a few things to cover before we get into our interview with Mike. And Peter, earlier this week, the runoff election in Mississippi was held between Thad Cochran and Chris McDaniel. And McDaniel's thought that they had a pretty good chance, actually, because he did best Cochran a month or so ago, which led to this runoff, because I don't think either one of them broke 50%. I think that was the threshold.
Correct. Yes.
But Cochran kind of reached across the aisle and actually started running ads about bringing money to Mississippi. He is a Republican in the most conservative state in the union, and he was running ads about spending tax dollars. And that was able to bring out a lot more typically Democratic voters, and he ended up beating McDaniel, and McDaniel has not conceded as of yet.
Yes, it's a rather pitiful spectacle to see McDaniel in that mode, and when he's been clearly been defeated, refusing to accept reality. But you may remember the Romney people, other than Romney himself, who managed to haul himself out onto the stage and concede. As a group, they were in shocked disbelief for about this amount of time after it happened. This guy's just not accepting reality, McDaniel. But the interesting thing, as you point out, Eric, is the reaching across the aisle, which is true. I would also call it reaching across the tracks, reaching across the cultural divide, the racial divide in Mississippi, which is the stuff of legend, let's just say. Not happy legend either. But having said all that, I see the force behind the force here as Haley Barbour, more than Thad Cochran himself, because frankly, Thad's getting on in years. I think he's probably, an okay senator for Mississippi as Mississippi goes, if you know what I mean. But Haley Barbour's really a political strategist of heavyweight proportions. I don't just mean that literally. And Haley knows the Republican machine. He doesn't just know it. He controls it, arguably, in Mississippi. And so he weighed in when he could see that after that first primary, where Cochran ran second to McDaniel in the runoff, Haley Barbour went into action and started to try to pull the base back together that he successfully used for himself to be elected governor, and also to help run other successful races. It was really Haley Barbour more than any one other individual who helped within Mississippi to make the Republican Party stronger than the Democratic Party, which is the reverse of what it used to be before the LBJ Goldwater days. Anyway, The guy, what I think we should take note of, and you and I discussed this for a while before the show, Eric, and I won't discuss it for so long now because we don't have the time, I realize. But I just want to say a thing about the gentleman who's running on the Democratic side. Congressman Travis Steeren, I believe, is Childers. Childers was elected to a district formerly represented by a guy named Pickering, a Republican. So it's a district that's purple, let's say, at best, probably really red, but winnable by a Democrat, obviously, because Travis won. I happen to have a personal friend with the Democrat state representative who ran against him in the Democratic primary that put him in that seat. And that was a close race, 53-47, more or less. But my friend, who's the Ag Committee, State House Committee Chair, warmly embraced his opponent after that fairly close primary, and it was a solid Democratic united front going into a special election to replace Congressman Pickering, and lo and behold, Steeren won. So it's not like the Democratic candidate against Cochran is, let's say, one of the African-American Democratic state legislators or somebody who you can say that person just will not be able to win with the amount of racism in Mississippi. The guy you got running for the Democrats is a white sort of redneck, certainly sounds politically incorrect, but let's just say he's a down-home country boy type of white Democratic candidate from the
old. It's a Dixiecrat.
Dixiecrat. Thank you, Eric. That's what I was trying to say. He's a Dixiecrat. And under the right circumstances, remember, as recently as the past decade, a decade ago, Mississippi elected a white governor. About 37% of Mississippi's population and voting population is black. That's a solid 99% for the Democrat there. But you do get also about, statistically speaking, from election to election, about 10%. And occasionally, obviously, it spiked up from Ronnie Musgrove, maybe closer to 20 or 25% of the whites will vote Democrat under some circumstances. You also have a very ticked off McDaniel contingent of Tea Partiers in Mississippi who are extremely, they are not only outraged that their candidate lost, so outraged they can't even admit that he lost when he has already lost, but they're especially, here's what really gets under their skin, and I hate to even talk about it because it's so awful, in the year 2014 or the year anything. But let's face it, yeah. There's racism in Mississippi. Well, hello. I hope everyone was sitting down before I announced that shocking news. So there's racism in Mississippi. But so it really ticks off the McDaniels people that Cochran reached over explicitly, specifically, no doubt about it, nobody denies it, to get African-American voters to cross over, which only in certain states can be done. Wisconsin's one of them. Mississippi's another. The majority of American states, you have to register by party and you can't vote in the other party's primary. But in Wisconsin, you can. It's been my experience in a lifetime here almost that most Wisconsin people don't understand why it is you can't vote in both primaries at the same time. And we're not going to take the time to explain it now. It's taken me 50 years. I haven't been able to explain it yet. But you can do it in Mississippi. They hate it. The McDaniels people hate it that Cochran had to rely on African-American votes to win the Republican nomination. And I could see a lot of them not bothering to even go out and vote. Probably not too many of them would actually vote for the Democrat, but I could see quite a few of them not voting for Cochran because they would hate him for reaching out to black voters. And if enough of them stay home and don't vote for Cochran, this Democratic congressman could conceivably, I'm not saying it's likely, but it's not out of the question, that he could pull it off. He's a good campaigner. And if he would pull that off, that could help the Democrats, that one vote. Things are so tight for the Democrats right now in the Senate, with so many seats up, that it might take a miracle like that to keep the Senate.
It definitely changes the game. There's a lot of people now on the Tea Party side that are pushing McDaniels to run in a write-in campaign, which it's still up for debate if that's even legal in Mississippi. Which, you know, on the surface in most states, if you're going to split the conservative vote, it would tend to make you think the Democrats are going to have a good chance, and it certainly helps. But looking at Thad Cochran's history of elections, he hasn't had a close race since 1988. In 2008, he won 62-38. In 2002, he won 84-16 because there wasn't a Democrat on the ticket. There was just a Reform Party.
It always helps to be unopposed.
In 96, it was 71-27. And then going back to 88, it was 54-46. And McDaniels still hasn't conceded. And I went through his so-called concession speech where he doesn't actually concede. And I pulled some stuff out. And I just want to play this for you and kind of dissect a couple of things.
The party I was born with, the party I joined when I was 13 years old, was the party of a man, a former actor from California named Ronald Reagan. And it was one afternoon, my father called me into the room and he says, listen, you've got to watch this. You've got to see what this man is saying. And he looked right at me. He looked right at my father. But he was really speaking to an entire nation. He talked about liberty and freedom. He talked about balanced budgets.
Right there, balanced budgets. It's really important to understand that Reagan didn't balance a budget. Reagan tripled the deficit. He was the first president to take our debt over $1 trillion.
It depends on your definition of balance. Let's put it that way.
And Cheney even is on record as saying Reagan taught us that deficits don't matter. So for this guy, it's either a complete lack of historical knowledge or it's just a purposely selective rhetoric
or some that he's pushing. Or some perverse combination of the two, because there is this among so many active members of the Republican base, which we can certainly call McDaniels that, there is this imagery of this legend of Reagan as the great, not only the great communicator, but the great conservative icon. And the fact of the matter is, as we've commented on this program before, just on policies, forget the name Ronald Reagan, just change the name, but put the same person, same looks, same views. A person with Ronald Reagan's positions on all of the issues.
We're going to get to that in just a second.
Could not possibly win a Republican primary in Mississippi or most states.
Let me keep playing this. We're going to get to that because he says more. Come on.
It was Reagan that said, we will be a party of bold colors, not pastels. And yet there are millions of people that feel like strangers in their own party. I want to be very, very clear. There is nothing dangerous or extreme about wanting to balance a budget.
Right there. On the surface, that sounds decent when he says there's nothing radical about wanting to balance a budget. The thing is, he's not telling you how he's going to do it. Is he going to cut food stamps, housing subsidies? Is he going to...
That is the definition for listeners who've heard the word demagoguery but don't necessarily feel like they have a complete grasp on what demagoguery is. That's demagoguery. Demagoguery is when a political person, it doesn't have to be political, but it usually is, when a political person makes a statement that on its face sounds like it could be true, therefore the proposition being put forth sounds reasonable. Because it's being phrased in a way that it sounds like it could be true. But what makes it demagoguery is when the speaker recognizes that he or she is twisting words so that there's just enough truthfulness to make it sound like it's plausible and should be embraced, when in fact that they know that the underlying facts are precisely the opposite of what they're trying to say.
I think you're giving him a lot of credit, and I don't think this new breed of conservative understands enough of what they're saying to be demagogues, to be doing what you're saying.
Maybe he stumbled upon demagoguery in the course of his normal affairs. He's a natural demagogue.
I think that we've just gotten to this point where these brainwashed Fox News Rush Limbaugh people are running for office now, and they don't know what they're talking about.
Then I'll agree with you on this. He's a dummy who just happens to be a natural demagogue.
And he's got more stuff to say. Let's keep going here.
But there is something a bit strange. There is something a bit unusual about a Republican primary that's decided by liberal Democrats.
No, there's not.
So much for bold colors. So much for principle. I guess they can take some consolation in the fact that they did something tonight by once again compromising, by once again reaching across the aisle.
Bang, right there. Again, this guy who claims to be a Reagan Republican has no idea that Reagan had to work with a Democratic Congress.
Reagan not only worked with the Democratic Congress, he and Tip O'Neill became famous friends. They opposed each other on many issues, but they sat down and worked. I don't know if they opened the whiskey bottle or whatever these Irishmen, one Protestant, one Catholic Irishman, did when they sat down at night, Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, but they came to some freaking
look what they did on Social Security. Exactly. Without working together, that never would have happened.
Precisely. So there's more, what, as you probably are correct in saying, it's maybe not conscious demagoguery, but it ends up being demagoguery because it sounds believable, but it's actually, in fact, not true. By not being able to work with the other side at all, you are doomed to accomplish absolutely nothing.
And, by once and again abandoning the conservative movement. This is not the party of Reagan.
No, it's not at all.
So thank you. As you know today, folks, there were literally dozens of irregularities reported all across this state. And you know why? You read the stories. You're familiar.
Because black people voted, apparently. That's the problem.
By their definition, that's irregularity. And they seem to have gotten Supreme Court Justice Roberts on board with that philosophy.
Now it's our job. Now it's our job to make sure that the sanctity of the vote is upheld.
Sanctity of our good, pure white votes, right?
Exactly. That right? is coming from a man from Mississippi.
That's what he wants. Okay? That's what he's, you know, I'm being bold enough to say out loud what that guy was really saying. I've been to the Neshoba County Fair, okay, more than once, because that's where the politicians go every election year in Mississippi, and I had occasion to have to be involved in that process for a little while. And I can tell you there's one guy who spoke at every county Neshoba County Fair I went to, which was several over the years. And he shows up every time, and he's one of these independent party, more white supremacists, and he'll stand up there, and there's hundreds of people right there. Hey, my white country rebels! And they squeeze him in between Haley Barbour and Ronnie Musgrove and Thad Cochran and you name it. And this guy's up there yelling, "White country rebels!" And I'm telling you, it's there. It's there.
Well,
it's
don't forget that after Reagan won the nomination in 1980, the first campaign stop he made was in Philadelphia, Mississippi, which is where the three people were killed. The three young men were killed for trying to register black voters. And he gave a speech about states' rights. Right. Okay? That's there. This is Nixon's Southern strategy. LBJ was
this
right.
This is our landfill. We'll bury our dead ones in this landfill here.
LBJ was right when he said that passing the Civil Rights Act lost the South, and it has for a generation. But, you know, in all honesty, some of it is starting to come back. We're short on time, so we need to keep moving forward here. So the whole point of this conversation is that the Republican Party is still split, and that what's going to happen in Mississippi now for the Senate election, I don't know, but we're seeing this outside of Mississippi as well. John Boehner came out, and we've been watching this guy try to run the House of Representatives for almost 4 years now, and he cannot corral these Tea Partiers and, you know, come up with compromises that they can get anything done. And personally, I don't think that he's able to. I don't think he generally wants to. I don't have the feeling that John Boehner really wants to do a good job. But he has announced now that he's going to sue the president. And he's suing over executive orders. The president has come out, fortunately, he's coming out swinging on this one. And here's just one of the comments, one of the lesser heard ones so far. Because he was on ABC and a couple other shows talking about this. But this one I didn't find until this morning.
They've decided they're going to sue me for doing my job. I might have said in the heat of the moment during one of these debates, I want to raise the minimum wage, so sue me when I do. But I didn't think they were going to take it literally.
That is the president. That is Barack Obama being Barack Obama right there. He's charismatic in that way, and he's able to use those things.
He's quick. I mean, not that he didn't maybe prepare that statement before he actually said it, but maybe not more than a few minutes before, or maybe a few hours. But the point is, he's sharp. He's very sharp, and I've been listening to some commentators who make a lot of sense to me, saying as recently as this morning, Eric on MSNBC, for example, that what Boehner's trying to do here is more, it isn't precisely what it appears. It appears that he's trying to be maybe appease some Tea Party activists or to just further burnish his anti-Obama credentials by bringing this lawsuit. But what the talking heads are saying that I am inclined to agree with is that it's really something quite the opposite of what it appears to be, which is so often the case with these Republicans. And that is that he is afraid there are enough Republicans in the House who have an appetite for the I word, the impeachment. Okay? He knows, Boehner's been around a while. He knows that impeachment last time around, when they tried a frivolous impeachment against President Clinton, what it ended up doing was costing them seats in both houses, perhaps not the majority in both houses, but they definitely lost seats in both houses, which is very unusual in a midterm for the party out of the White House, especially out of the White House when the guy in the White House is being impeached, and the Democrats picked up seats in both houses. Okay? Boehner's aware of this. And I think what Boehner's trying to do, at least other people seem to think so, and I have no reason to disagree with him at this point, is what he's trying to do is distract from the impeachment because he knows that they, by suing the president, they can show that they're still against him, keep those anti-Obama credentials burnished, but at the same time, it's not so serious as an impeachment. And he doesn't want to go down that road because the 2014 midterms, if anything's going to bring out the Democratic base, it'll be if these freaks actually try to impeach President Barack Obama. And that will bring out midterm voters like it did in 98. It'll bring out, I knew one, I think I told you before, Eric, about one attorney in New York State who's a Republican, who very big-time attorney. He's argued in front of the U.S. Supreme Court and all this stuff. And he's always voted Republican. And he told me, Peter, this time I spoke to him in 1998, right after that election. And we happened to, the subject turned to politics. And I said, well, Mike, what did you do this? Did you still vote Republican? He said, no, I voted for every Democrat on the ballot. He said, because I'm a constitutional attorney. And I'm not a Democrat, I'm a Republican. Never voted Democrat before. But this impeachment, as a constitutional law expert, which I consider myself, he said, this impeachment is a disgrace to the Republican Party. There is no way that the Founding Fathers, who framed the Constitution of the United States, intended for impeachment to be applied to this kind of set of circumstances. And he said, I voted for every Democrat on the ballot.
I think the way that we know that this is just a sham is, on one hand, first off, Boehner is not giving any specifics. He says that he doesn't like that the president is using executive power and that he needs to be upholding the Constitution, but he's not talking about anything specifically that the president has done that he doesn't like. Now, Obama is issuing executive orders at a rate of 0.09 per day. All right. That's the lowest rate since Grover Cleveland. That means that both Bushes, Reagan, Nixon, Eisenhower, Hoover, Coolidge, Harding, Taft, Teddy Roosevelt, McKinley, and Harrison, essentially every Republican president since 1889 has issued more executive orders than Barack Obama. Yet all of a sudden it's an issue. Now, sure, here's something else that people don't realize.
You understand why it's an issue, right? Because it's Barack Obama.
Because it's Obama. But
there's no other reason.
Well, here's some things that people don't understand. Here's a list of executive orders that maybe people don't realize were executive orders. The Emancipation Proclamation in 1862. The WPA under FDR in 1935. That included the Civilian Conservation Corps, which employed 8.5 million people. Truman desegregated the armed forces in 1948 with an executive order. Ulysses S. Grant created Indian reservations with an executive order. The Equal Employment Opportunity was passed by LBJ with an executive order. Affirmative action by JFK. School desegregation by Ike. And JFK created the Peace Corps with an executive order.
Well, all of those presidents were sued by Congress and subsequently impeached, right?
Well, unfortunately, no. I don't think any of them were, actually.
Wait, maybe those Congresses just weren't as alert and intelligent as this Congress.
I'm sure that's the case.
That must have been it.
Obama, to date, has issued 168 executive orders. That compares to 291 by W, 364 by Clinton, 166 by Big Bush, but he only had one term. Obama's 1.5 terms in.
Right.
Reagan had 381. Carter had... I'm not sure if maybe I doubled this up. I have Reagan and Carter at 381. And JFK had 214, but he only had 1,000 days in office.
And he exceeded what Obama's done.
He has. And FDR had some 3,700 that he did over his 12 years in office.
That must and each one of them resulted in a lawsuit and impeachment, right? No, wait. He was elected 4 times.
Followed by Truman, who was a Democrat and elected, and then Eisenhower, who they thought was going to run as a Democrat, and then by JFK and LBJ. So if, you know, Eisenhower being, you know, the oddball who didn't establish a party until he realized people might be getting sick of Democrats, so he threw the R in front of his name. So maybe Boehner should think about that. Maybe these are things that people need, and maybe the public isn't quite as upset about it as he and his party are. So we're gonna see what happens here. The president is trying to laugh it off, and the Republicans are, you know, here's the other thing is that the Republicans are looking at stretching this out into the court system. These are the guys who are so against government spending. John Boehner's not paying for this out of his own pocket. Okay, Ted Cruz won't pay for this out of his own pocket. This is coming from the taxpayers. And the Republicans, you remember when they ran in 2010 and they said, we won't pass any legislation without taking that money from somewhere else. There will be no new spending. Where are they going to get this money from? You know, they're going to cut more food stamps. They're going to cut more unemployment.
If they could.
I mean, these are the guys.
If they could, they would.
These are the guys that blew up the deficit under George W. Bush after Clinton had balanced it. And these are the guys who spent $24 billion to shut down the government last fall in a failed attempt to get rid of Obamacare. We'll see what happens. We're actually out of time here. We're going to go now to our recorded interview with Mike McCabe. And I really encourage all of you to stick around for this. I will be back briefly afterwards, but that is going to do it for Peter's segment today. So, Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you, Eric. Good show.
It has been a good show. And we are now going to jump into our conversation with Mike McCabe. And I hope you all enjoy it. And joining us now on the line is Executive Director of Wisconsin Democracy Campaign and the author of the new book, Blue Jeans in High Places, friend of the show, Mike McCabe. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm good, Eric. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. It looks like you have been doing some stuff behind the scenes here, and you've got a brand new book coming out. Can you kind of tell us a little bit about it and what inspired you to write it?
Well, I have been writing a book over the course of recent months, and it's now written, and I've found a publisher, and the publisher tells me that it will be out sometime around September 1st, and I'm excited about it. What inspired me to write it is just all of the interactions that I've had with people in every corner of Wisconsin, in small towns and big cities. What I've encountered there is really increasing feelings of hopelessness and resignation to the condition of our democracy. That, you know, and yet at the same time that people express these feelings of resignation, there's still a hunger that I pick up on that they want to be part of something that can rescue democracy, and they realize that both major parties are failing Wisconsin and failing America. They realize that our democracy is in worse condition than it's been at any time in living memory. And you know, there have been plenty of words written about what's gone haywire, how the system has gotten so messed up. I wanted to write a book about a way out. I wanted to give people some steps that could be taken that could actually breed a citizen movement to resuscitate democracy and to reconnect people with the political process in a meaningful way. And as I talk to people all across the state and at so many different kinds of events, that's where I got the idea and the inspiration for writing this book. And now I hope that book can plant some seeds that can grow into a citizen movement that can transform political parties that are failing us and really build housing for the politically homeless. There are an awful lot of people who don't feel that either major party represents them. They don't feel that their voices are being heard. They don't believe their interests are being served. And they really feel politically homeless. And this book is about building housing for those people.
That sounds fantastic. It sounds like something that a lot of people are going to be interested in. You hit on a lot of points here, and now I have to admit to our listeners, I haven't been able to read the book, but Mike did send me a nice synopsis here. And I'd like to kind of go through some of the points that you laid out here, because I think you've got some really good stuff here. In the introduction of the synopsis here, you had mentioned, kind of to sum it up, that we live in an ever-changing world, yet politics have kind of remained static. And it sounds, you know, something that I've always noticed, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, is that, you know, especially the Republican Party, they like to talk about, you know, the old Warren Harding phrase, you know, more business in government, less government in business. And they talk like they want the government to operate like a corporation, yet every company that I've ever worked for has had to fight to stay ahead of the curve and remain competitive and be innovative and progressive and try new things and buy new equipment and bring in new people. And, you know, they just have to stay ahead of that curve. Yet the things that we could be doing as a country, high-speed rail, investing in education, healthcare, things like that, just they fall on deaf ears, and we're falling behind the rest of the world. And you made the point that democracy is a living thing, and in America it's in a state of suspended animation. I think that's really interesting that you bring that up, because, again, you know, and I'm not trying to make this partisan, but the Republicans like to talk about the Constitution a lot. And one of the things that Jefferson believed was that the Constitution was a living, breathing thing, and it should be reformed every 19 or 20 years. Is that kind of how this book is approaching the subject?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. We're stuck in a rut. There's no question about it. And just about everything has changed in American life from the time of our nation's founding. The food we eat, the way we dress, the houses we live in, the way we travel, everything about our lives is different. The way we communicate with each other, everything about American life has changed, and yet we still have two major parties with the same symbols that they've had since the 19th century, and we have a political vocabulary that has largely gone unchanged for generations and generations. And one of the things I started talking to people about as I traveled the state of Wisconsin was the fact that we've been trained to think horizontally about politics. Who's on the left, who's on the right, who's in the middle, who's liberal, who's conservative, who's moderate. And I've said to people, you know, a really magical thing happens if you flip that political spectrum up on its head and you start to think vertically instead of horizontally. And I give people an example. You take let's take a man who lives in Clark County, which is where I grew up, about halfway between Eau Claire and Wausau, rural county, more cows than people in Clark County. And you know, he's white. He's probably poor, because Clark County is one of the five poorest counties in Wisconsin. and he's Republican. Scott Walker won Clark County in 2012 by over 30 percentage points. Now take a woman living in Milwaukee. Let's say she's African American. Let's say she's also low income. There are a lot of major low income population in Milwaukee. She's considered liberal. She's Democrat. Those two people couldn't be farther apart on the political spectrum if you think horizontally. But if you flip the spectrum up vertically, and you don't think about who's on the left and who's on the right, but you think about who's on top and who's on the bottom, you think about the who are the royals and who are the commoners in our society, and those two people are in exactly the same spot on the political spectrum. So the way we think about politics and the way we talk about politics needlessly divides people who could be united. And so we've allowed ourselves to be brainwashed, to be trained to think and act and talk about politics in ways that divide us and keep us from coming together as a country. And we've fallen prey to this business model that has taken root in politics. And central to that business model is the idea that there's only one political currency that matters, and that's money. Well, there, I can think of at least two other political currencies that in the past have had enormous power, and yet we've been trained to push those aside or forget them. And organized people, that's a political currency. Provocative ideas is a political currency, and those two particular currencies were once married in our past to create a force that was strong enough to overcome the power of organized money. Standard Oil wasn't strong enough to overcome those political currencies. The railroad and timber barons weren't powerful enough. The Vanderbilts, the Carnegies, the Rockefellers weren't strong enough. Their organized money wasn't potent enough to overcome the marriage of organized people and provocative ideas. We need to get those alternative political currencies back into circulation. That's really what this book is about, is trying to break down the way we've been trained to think and encourage innovation in terms of the way we think and talk about politics to help break us out of this rut. And it, unfortunately, both major parties have embraced this business model that prevails in politics today. They talk and they think about politics horizontally instead of vertically. If we as citizens begin to break free of that and liberate ourselves from that kind of training, there's an enormous potential for us to really remake the political landscape in a way that would serve ordinary citizens.
So it sounds like you're kind of calling for a huge revolution. What you're talking about. I like the what you said about the poor man in Clark County and the poor woman in Milwaukee County, because I think that is that right there. That just sums it up perfectly, because that is just so true about what we're seeing. But how do we break through? How do we get them to understand? You mentioned in the book that, I'm quoting from what you sent me here. You said, when American politics twice before underwent extensive remodeling, it did not happen in the nation's capital. Curiously enough, the renovation was engineered in my home state of Wisconsin, of all places. What two renovations are you talking about? Are you referring to the Republican Party and the Progressive Party, or what are you looking at?
Yeah, back in the 1850s, people went into a little white schoolhouse in Ripon, Wisconsin. They entered that schoolhouse as Democrats and as Whigs. The Whig Party was one of the two major parties in America at the time. Some of them called themselves Free Soilers. They went in as Democrats and Whigs and Free Soilers, and they came out of that schoolhouse calling themselves Republicans. They created a new political identity that they used to transform a political system that wasn't working for them. Now, it was a big part of it was this was an abolitionist movement. Both the Democrats and the Whigs at the time were ostensibly pro-slavery. And there was a growing anti-slavery movement at the time that couldn't find a home in either of the two major parties, and so they created a new identity. And that act of simply stopping calling themselves the labels that they had for years was transformative. And it happened again then in the late 1800s, because somebody like Fighting Bob La Follette, who was a Republican, grew to believe that his party had grown corrupt over the course of a couple of generations. And what Bob La Follette did is he simply decided to stop calling himself a Republican and start calling himself a progressive. And out of that, by just forging a new identity, that grew into a movement that ended up transforming both of the major parties at the time, to the point where Teddy Roosevelt ran on the Republican ticket for president as a progressive, and some years later, Woodrow Wilson ran for president on the Democratic ticket as a progressive. They embraced the progressive agenda. They embraced the new identity because the citizenry embraced that new identity. These are what I would call first-party movements as opposed to third-party movements. With a third-party movement, the goal is to have three or more parties. With a first-party movement, the goal is really to have one party that's worth a damn, one party that is truly connected to the people and responsive to the people. And it's aimed not at creating more parties, but creating at least one party that truly owes its allegiance to the citizenry and is loyal to the citizenry. And it seems to me that we are right back in the same kinds of conditions that those Democrats and Whigs and Free Soilers were encountering back in the 1850s, and that those progressives were facing back in the 1890s, where they were politically homeless. And what did they do but launch a first party movement that transformed the political system and forced the political establishment either to adapt or perish, either to reconnect with the people in a meaningful way or be driven to extinction. And it seems to me that that's what our job is, that's what our challenge is as citizens today. A lot of people are feeling politically homeless. The percentage of Americans who refuse to identify with either the Democratic or Republican parties is at its highest level in three quarters of a century. A lot of people don't feel that they're being represented. They don't feel their voices are being heard or their interests are being served. And so I think it's our obligation now to respond to these conditions that are so eerily reminiscent of the Gilded Age, the age of the robber barons at the end of the 19th century. We face conditions that so resemble what people back then faced, and I think we have to respond just as creatively as they did. And I think it really cries out for the establishment of a new political identity, not to create a third party, but to create a party that is reconnected to the people. Instead of owing its allegiance to wealthy interests, we need a party that truly is willing to work for the people.
Mike, would you agree that in 2008, when Obama ran for president, that there was a lot of hope that he was going to be taking one of the establishment parties in a new direction, in a progressive direction that really that created a mood that really rallied people, and that didn't happen. We've seen obstruction from the right. We've also seen just a president that's really governing more from the center, which then sparked some outrage and created the Tea Party, which is now fizzling out. And then on the other side, it sparked Occupy, which fizzled out. Do you think, and this is just something that I've always kind of been waiting to see happen here, considering that it really looks like things are lined up to go the way that you're predicting, do you think it's possible that the Republican Party could fizzle out with the baby boomers. The Democrats maybe stay where they are, attract a few more corporates, and, you know, maybe go a little bit more to the right. And then we see what you're calling a first party, a new progressive party that occupies the true left. And I guess just to expand on that and make it a two-part question, what do you think that would mean for someone like Bernie Sanders in 2016?
Well, there's actually a chapter in the book called Millennials to the Rescue. And I think as the millennial generation, the teens and 20-somethings of today mature and they get to the point where they start to take over and get into the driver's seat of American democracy, they are going to change the landscape dramatically. They think in a considerably different fashion than the rest of the population. I think that's going to be a transformative generation in the end. But I think one of the things that I've encountered a lot as I travel around Wisconsin and give a lot of presentations, I've been doing a lot of discussions after screenings of the movie Citizen Coke lately, and invariably one of the things that happens is somebody raises their hand and says, well, isn't Bernie Sanders the answer? Or isn't Elizabeth Warren the answer? And it's like they keep looking for saviors, and I think Barack Obama certainly represented that for a lot of people. And that's what I say in response is that here again is where we've become captive of our own vocabulary. We've been trained to think of elected officials as our nation's leaders or our state's leaders or our community's leaders. I can't think of a single class of people less involved with leadership than politicians. They are consummate followers. They constantly are reading polls. They constantly got the finger to the wind, checking the direction of the currents. They're constantly watching how the political currents are flowing, and increasingly watching how the money is flowing. And you know, I think true leadership always comes from the citizenry. It doesn't come from the politicians. It comes from the people. Lyndon Johnson didn't lead when he signed the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act. He was forced to do that by a movement that left him with no alternative. And I think an even more powerful contemporary example is what's happened in the battle for marriage equality and gay rights. For years, you had politicians taking actions, banning gay marriage and taking a very stridently anti-gay positions until you even had the Democrats opposed to gay marriage. The best that Obama would say is maybe we should have civil unions. And Democrats were afraid to take a stand in favor of marriage equality, true marriage equality. And Republicans were, on the other hand, trying to pass anti-gay legislation and ban gay marriage and say that marriage has to be one man and one woman. Until the prevailing opinion, the consensus in America, reached the point where over half of Americans clearly believed in marriage equality, and all of a sudden you saw the politicians scurrying to change their positions. Democrats wholeheartedly embracing marriage equality, a lot of Republicans saying, we just don't have a position on this issue anymore. The people who led were those advocates for marriage equality who, every time there was a referendum, every time there was a vote in a legislature, they were losing again and again and again for years, and yet they were slowly but surely changing hearts and minds. And once enough hearts and minds were changed, then laws started to change. And you're seeing that play out in Wisconsin and all across the country. Real leadership will always come from citizens, not politicians. And so the goal of a first-party movement, a goal of a transformative reform movement, is not to produce an occasional Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. It's to create conditions where the mainstream politicians, the Harry Reids and the John Boehners, have no choice but to behave more like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. That's what La Follette and the progressives accomplished. They created conditions where mainstream politicians like Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson eventually had no choice but to embrace the progressive agenda and run as progressives, because they knew that they would not win elections if they didn't. So that citizen leadership will have fully flowered when you see people like Harry Reid and John Boehner running for cover, because they know if they don't behave more like a Bernie Sanders or an Elizabeth Warren, they can't survive politically. But that's going to require citizen leadership, not a savior, whether it's a Barack Obama or an Elizabeth Warren or a Bernie Sanders. We can't look for saviors. We have to understand that the power to really transform American politics actually only resides within us.
Very, very well said. Always appreciate your thoughts. We're getting tight on time, Mike. And I do have one more subject I wanted to ask you about really quick. Is there any final thoughts on the book before we move forward?
No, I hope that that people will keep an eye out for it. I've teamed up with a local independent publisher, Little Creek Press, to put this out. I'm told that it'll be out around September 1st, and I hope, like I said, that it can plant some seeds that can grow into something that can establish a movement that we need to rescue democracy in our country.
Is it anything that people can pre-order on Amazon, or are you not going to do Amazon? Where can people find it?
It will eventually be on Amazon. It'll also be available through the online bookstore that Little Creek Press runs, and I think also Barnes & Noble is going to pick it up, but it's not yet out there on any of those. Hopefully will be soon, and I'll certainly try to spread the word as broadly as I can once it is.
Fantastic. I think we're all going to be looking forward to that. It sounds like it's going to be really, really good. Moving forward, just the last thing I wanted to ask you about is I'd like to hear your thoughts on what happened last week with Scott Walker and the meme coming out with the criminal scheme, with the John Doe. Where do you see this taking the current election? And more importantly, what does this case mean for politics, considering money and coordination with outside groups? It sounds like Scott Walker is kind of the embodiment of everything that you wrote this book against.
Yeah, you know, once these latest revelations broke, what we've seen is Governor Walker and his defenders really flailing around wildly to try to come up with an answer that is even semi-persuasive. The governor tried to say that the investigation is over and no wrongdoing was found. That nobody's bought that. They've tried to argue that everybody's doing it, and to me that's a justification for more John Doe investigations, not ending the one we already have. And of course they've really hammered away at this idea that this investigation is a partisan witch hunt. And of course, that's undercut by the fact that the special prosecutor is a Republican, and a couple of the district attorneys involved in this are Republicans, and the Government Accountability Board, the judges on the Government Accountability Board that authorized the investigation, many of them were Republican appointees as well. And so everything that they've tried hasn't stuck. So now it almost seems like they're accepting the fact that, yes, they engaged in this activity that for a long time has been illegal in Wisconsin, but they're advancing this theory that it shouldn't be illegal, that it actually should be legal. And all I can say is that I don't have a good enough crystal ball to say how this is going to affect the 2014 election. But if this theory that has been advanced, that all of this should be legal, if that stands up in court, the impact that it's going to have on future elections is going to be immense. We're talking about the death of disclosure, the death of all campaign contribution limits. What we'll be left with is shadow campaigns orchestrated by candidates but carried out by anonymous proxies, by surrogates that don't have to disclose their money and that can raise unlimited amounts of money to put politicians in office and the public will be kept in the dark about who paid to put those elected officials in those offices. That would be an escalation of the disastrous effects that we've seen damaging democracy in recent years.
Well said, as always. Mike McCabe of Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, Blue Jeans in High Places is the book. It'll be available sometime around September. Thank you so much for joining us, Mike.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Eric.
And just one more thing that I would like to add as after what Mike had to say. Mike was really adamant that we shouldn't be looking for saviors and that Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Barack Obama are not the answer, that we need to have a citizen movement and the people need to stand up. I wholeheartedly agree with that, but I also believe that someone needs to rise out of that group of people to run for the office, because you have to have a senator, a congressman, a city councilman, a president who can actually cast the votes and who has the authority. And with that said, that can be you, that can be me, that can be your brother-in-law, if you know someone who can step up and has the qualities that are needed in order to get out there and represent what the people are wanting and be there to vote for a constitutional amendment against money or to help get gay marriage passed in your state, whatever, whatever it is that you think is important. So although I'm not disagreeing with Mike in any way, but I do think that I would personally take it just one step farther, that someone needs to rise up and stand up and be the person who's willing to run as a representative. That's going to do it for our show this week. I want to give a thanks to Janesville Community Radio. You're listening to Civil Discourse, and we're here every Saturday at 11 o'clock Central Standard Time at 11 a.m. Just go to blogtalkradio.com, do a search for Janesville Community Radio, click on their link, and then the link for Civil Discourse, and you can hear us live. Thank you to JCR for this platform. And remember that anyone in the Janesville area, Janesville Community Radio is in the process of becoming an actual FM station, and we're having a fundraiser tomorrow at Palmer Park. It's going to be most of the day. If you want to show up, maybe around noon, there's going to be food, games, and the proceeds are going to Janesville Community Radio so that we can build a tower and get our studio in order, and we'll actually be broadcasting on the air. So all of your favorite shows, like Yuri Rashkin and Daddy-O's Lunch Bucket, The Open Mic, and of course Civil Discourse, will all be available on your FM radios. Thank you to the Rock County Progressives, the Rock County Dems, the Econawalk Dems. Thank you to 350 Madison for all of the work that you guys are doing. And thank you to Mike McCabe for joining us and giving us such a thoughtful interview this week. Make sure you pay attention to when his book is coming out, Blue Jeans in High Places, and it should be available right around September 1st. Again, this is Civil Discourse. I'm Eric Brandt. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks, because next week is the 4th of July. Have a good one.